when I think about productivity, I do ask myself, what are the lies or the traps that I'm falling into that make me think that the product is more important than the process? That what I generate is more important than how I generate it or why I generate it or who I am generating it for.
I'm your host, Caitlin Salamini, and this is the Postpartum Production Podcast. Here, we hold conversations about the intersection of caregiving, creative practice, and capitalist production, as well as what it means to be producing art while also being a parent in modern society. Find out more at www.postpartumproduction.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. To start today, because this episode is sort of coming in out of the blue in some ways as a bonus episode, I was thinking about a lot of different things, and I also wanted to give an update on why it's been a while since we've had an episode. So I was thinking specifically about a very lovely and well-meaning friend who once many years ago said to me, "I want to be like you. I want to not work." At the time, I was working, or I guess in her mind, not working on my first novel, while also building a small startup business. I'd abandoned teaching part-time, as many of you probably know, the near impossible adjunct teaching grind, as well as freelancing, which can feel equally impossible. Both jobs that were rewarding in some ways, but didn't pay enough, I thought. Writing certainly didn't pay enough, but I was fortunate to have a partner whose finance job did pay enough. So I was in a place in my early to mid 30s where I could concentrate on my art, like artists of generations ago, I suppose, who had benefactors. And I knew I was uniquely fortunate in this regard. As we all know, art, the art that I think all of us who are here and listening aim to create, sits so much outside the bounds of capitalism. And we all know that art when we see it. Perhaps it defies definition, or it pushes the boundaries of our lived experience, or it says the thing you've been trying to say in words or images, and it does that in a way you didn't expect or you didn't expect to feel confronted by. I suppose then, I guess I've been not working for quite some time on a number of projects, this podcast notwithstanding. But through all this, I've had also this itch to do work that feels tangible, that feels human, and can mostly sit within capitalist bounds, albeit, again, not really paid or valued. So along those lines, earlier this year, I decided to take a leap and apply to master's in social work programs. In classic mom braid mode, I applied to three of them and somehow missed a form for one of them. So that application was deemed incomplete, which I only learned when I went to see whether or not I had gotten in. Of the other two, I was rejected from one and accepted to another. This acceptance alone felt like a validation, like I was meant to do this. Could I do this? I asked. I'm still asking this question. As I balance, or really as I splay myself in all directions to catch numerous balls in the air at once, I can't shake art and I can't shake this podcast. That said, the podcast is on an indefinite hiatus while I hold at least four balls in the air, which include my motherhood and caregiving, writing as I'm working on a second novel revision, my social work coursework, which is way more tedious than anticipated, and the activism that I've referred to previously on the podcast. So I am still doing the grind of ensuring public education in San Francisco is supported and thriving. Yet despite all this, when my dear friend and Postpartum Production podcast super fan, Megan Leonard's new book of poems was released this fall, I knew I had to dig in with her. She is a mother of many, or to be specific, four children, which is one more than me, which also means I look to her for all things like, how the heck can I parent all these kids and still be a writer? In this way, she often reminds me of Mother Ginger in the Nutcracker, you know, that like poised, beautiful woman who's hiding seemingly endless children under her ballooning dress. But more than children, Meg pulls so many rabbits out of her hat, including her latest publication, Larkspur Queen, which is a stunning work of poetry and imagination and a contemporary expansion on the medieval lace I'm not going to be able to say this right. Lay of Marie de France. Lay of Marie de France. The earliest known French woman poet. I am still slayed, as my kids say, or rizzed, or like, I don't know, 6'7" by these lines. In Meg's, anyone who thinks thunderstorms are romantic has never lived in an attic apartment on top of a hill in an otherwise flat city. Such a great title. But here's the line that I love. Ah, but what we want is a changed life. We want to be shaking. We want to be certain. Everything the woman ever thought is wrong. The skin can't tell the difference between very hot and very cold. It only knows it's ruined. And we are all skin creatures, loving tight jeans, silk pajamas, iced cream, hot coffee. At the same time, her poem, The Princess and the Falcon, reminded me of a ridiculous online debate recently about a mother who dropped her kids off to school while wearing a robe and a towel on her head, which, I mean, I was just like, you do you to this mom, and also was annoyed that in the online debate, everyone seemed to ignore, like, where are the other caregivers? Does she have a partner who's helping, a grandparent, an aunt? Why is this mother so strung out that she needs to go to school in her robe? You know, this is not her fault. This is maybe society's fault. And also, who the heck cares ultimately? But anyway, I digress. I thought of that when reading another one of Meg's poems, The Princess and the Falcon, and this line specifically, which I loved. And what makes people more angry than a woman who truly loves herself? A woman who has nothing to buy, no shame about her choices, her singing voice, her baggy sweater. So as Meg knows, I'm usually wearing a baggy sweater most days. But above all, Meg is one of those rare gems of a friend who you meet in the most unexpected way, online. I have a few precious friendships that began online and continued IRL, as I think my kids also say. But either way, I'm so grateful that this podcast brought Meg and I together in friendship and finally in this conversation. So I'm excited to share an unexpected bonus episode to our podcast season, or we could call this a standalone season in itself, as Meg will address in this conversation, this season of caregiving, of artistry, of wanting a changed life, and of perhaps living one too. I am really excited to talk to you because whenever I talk about the podcast and is anyone listening, I'm like, Meg is listening.
I know.
It's like, Meg is our super fan. And I know others are listening too, but you've been so supportive. And I feel like what's fun, and I was explaining this to a friend actually today, is that even though we met through Arum, we really connected through the podcast. So it feels like you may be one of very few friendships that's come directly out of this podcast, which is really lovely.
Yeah, I think so too. I feel like because you're a West Coast person, I knew who you were in the Arum. You know what? I actually remember what it was. So after Winslow was born, my fourth child, it was October 2020, and your baby was born sometime in the following year, but I don't remember when.
2021. Yep.
December. And I remember you sharing about the podcast in the Arum group. And I thought to myself, oh my God, finally, someone is going to talk about the thing that I want to talk about.
Aww.
Because I felt like I was finding all of these supportive motherhood spaces, which I desperately needed, and I was so glad to have. And I was finding all of these supportive poetry spaces and writing spaces, and a lot of them were geared towards women, and they weren't not including mothers. But I couldn't find the little overlap where people with little kids, like babies, sort of up all night, were still writing books and talking about how the hell they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it was. That's why you were on my radar with the Arum. But it was when you announced the podcast, I was like, oh, I have to listen to this. And then, yeah, that is, we became, you know, real friends instead of just people who know each other. And I can even remember running in the rain and listening to the podcast. And I wasn't newly postpartum, but my baby was around a year or something. And just being so upset when an episode would end because I'd have to wait Oh. Another episode. You know, in those days when all four of my kids were really little, mm-hmm. I just felt I didn't see other people in the trenches with me in the same way. Mm-hmm. Like I said, mm-hmm. find overwhelmed moms. I could find writers trying to find their space in a horrendous publishing mm-hmm. universe. But that overlap just wasn't showing up for me. And so, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, this podcast has been kind of a lifeline for me.
Oh, I really appreciate that.
My kids are bigger. My youngest is 4 now, so it doesn't feel as desperate as mm-hmm. it did, you know, when the podcast started, but it's still mm-hmm. a real source of light and rejuvenation.
I really appreciate that. And I think, as with you, it was born out of that desperation for me too. So it makes a lot of sense and resonates with me, because I had the exact same feeling, where I think there's something in those early days of caregiving where you just feel so disconnected from certain parts of yourself, and then can also feel really connected to them. And then it's really confusing, because how do you access that, and when and where, and then what comes of that? And obviously, I mean, we've talked a lot about this on the podcast, and it's talked about in so many, thankfully, in a lot of literature now and around our subculture of creative mothers. But I was just thinking about productivity and how I think there's just obviously so much pressure to produce something like this absolutely amazing new book of poetry that you have that I'm holding up for you and you alone, since we don't show the video of this. But yeah, Larkspur Queen, which we'll obviously talk about, and we'll have notes too that people can access your book and read your work. But I was also really hoping in this podcast to hear, because I don't know if you and I've sat down and dug deep around who is Meg, and who is Meg as a writer, and who is Meg as a mother, and who is Meg as a person in the world, and all the different hats that you wear, and especially how you've navigated this journey. And I think it's interesting, because while you're saying that you felt that desperation, I can feel in you such a connector. You're such a person that brings people together, as you've done in our last episode of season. And so I just think you're a real tenderer. Like, I was going to say caregiver, but it's more than that. You tend to things. And I think you tend to connections. And I'm really curious about that.
Oh, that's kind of you to say. I think I just crave them so much. So it's funny, because I am very much an introvert. I need a lot of mm-hmm. time and space by myself. It's also a little ironic sometimes to be an introvert with 4 children. You know, because they want to be in my space as much as possible. And I want to be in their space as much as possible, too. And then also, I need so much quiet in my mind to think. And I think with other people, with friendships and relationships, I crave understanding people authentically. I don't think I do that well with more superficial connections. I think I don't understand them very well. And I didn't realize that I didn't understand them very well until I was much older. I think, you know, I was always a little bit of a weirdo with my weird friends, and we would just sit down and like talk about our souls immediately. And so I thought that's just kind of what people did. Obviously, I spent a lot of time with other poets. This kind of thing isn't strange in creative circles necessarily. And then in adulthood, having all these different interactions with people all the time, work, coworkers, neighbors, with children, I'm interacting with my kids, friends, parents, and all the other people at school, the teachers, the administrators, all the people who make childhood function in our contemporary society. And nobody wanted me to just ask them how their soul was on the playground, you know, or anything. They did not want me to cry, you know, in front of the slides. They did not want me to ask them how their marriage was really doing. I got a lot of unhappy faces, and I was like, oh shit, this isn't really how I'm supposed to do it. And I feel like I'm a little better now at small talk than I was maybe 10 years ago, but it's just not really my strength. And so I think what you notice in me loving good conversation with like-minded people when I meet them is just that I like to know people's truths and I like to be honest with people. And I don't necessarily find it scary, which I think is maybe just a function of being a poet. And I miss it in adult life sometimes, you know, because it's not always appropriate.
I really appreciate that, though, because I feel like I'm very similar. And I've recently, I can't remember where, I was filling out something, some paperwork, maybe for some sort of evaluation for our kids or something. And it was around that exact topic of small talk of, are you comfortable or do you need to have deeper connections? And I think it is definitely a part of a neurodivergence, whatever that might be. But I feel exactly the same way. And I think it's not an accident that I enjoy these kinds of conversations. I haven't shared yet on the podcast, but that I've gone back to school to get an MSW degree, which I will eventually talk a little bit more about. But yeah, I am like you, an introvert. And also people who know me are like, but you're not into, like, my relationship with you doesn't make me feel like you're an introvert. You're very giving, you're very open with me. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So I totally feel that. And I think these binaries are not very useful, right? In terms of one, the other, we shape shift and they're kind of containers of thought, but not necessarily practice. So I appreciate that. And I definitely am drawn to people like you. So this is just going to be a love fest episode, I guess. Where you just like, you know, like we just feel comfortable and you just make me feel comfortable. Like I haven't known you that long, like you're saying, you know, in terms of the podcast and the times that we've met in person when we've been in the same physical spaces, but I feel an ease. I feel like I could walk into your house and go to your fridge and hang out and
you definitely
feel very comfortable.
Maybe that we feel so comfortable because I literally did just walk into your house the first time I met you.
And oh, like, that's true.
In your guest bedroom. I mean, it wasn't, I think you were renting.
Yeah.
While your family was visiting.
Yeah.
Your exactly. immediate family yeah. was visiting yeah. your extended family. But I literally did just flop in and be like, hi, nice to meet you. I'm going to write an essay in your spare bedroom now.
And it's an essay that has been published. And that is also amazing. That's right. We need to highlight that. Speaking of work and productivity, I'd love to hear that work, your poetry, what that has looked like. I know you've shared with me personally a little bit about where you've worked. I love, shout out to White Heron in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and the spaces and the communities. But can you walk me through a little bit of that in terms of the genesis of that essay and also this collection?
I love talking about productivity and I love some of the conversations that you've had on this podcast. Again, one of the reasons why this podcast has been a light for me is these conversations around productivity, because what I don't hear you saying on the podcast or the guests saying either, well, if you want it bad enough, you just have to work harder, not smarter. You know, no, the other way around, work smarter, not harder, right? See, I can't even get the like stupid sayings right. I'm chronically ill and have dealt with chronic illness and disability since my teens and 20s, which I think is a little different. Sometimes because I'm 44 now and I'm finding more and more people are joining me as we age, we're getting, you know, that's part of it. Like if you live long enough, you're going to experience disability. So I feel like people who are in the chronic illness boat with me, there's more of them now, but when I was younger, there really weren't. And so, you know, I just didn't know as many people dealing with these kinds of things because I was young and it's not as common. And so I would meet these, you know, these disability communities and they became very, very important to me. And I learned so much from other people who were sort of committed to disability activism in sort of dismantling the idea that our worth is tied to our work or our productivity. And also dismantling the idea that being productive in some sort of quantifiable way is even desirable. Like it is a capitalist ruse. And I feel like the other young people, mostly young women, but other young people that I met during that time when I was sort of coming to terms with chronic illness myself, just laying some of that out for me. And showing me how ableist it was to imagine that a really good writer is churning out a book a year, or really, like if you're really serious about about your art, then you are producing. And instead recognizing that caring deeply about your art means you stay connected to it throughout your life. And that might look like really different things. It might mean writing for 15 minutes a day, and we all know you can get a book that way. And anyone who's ever tried to write for 15 minutes a day knows that it's not actually sustainable for most people. Like, it's one of these things that they tell you is like this great hack, right? Like, you're really busy. You have a full-time job. You've got kids. You've taken care of your grandma, all this stuff. Just wake up 15 minutes earlier and work on your book for 15 minutes a day. And before you know it, you're going to have, you know, hundreds of pages. And anyone who's actually tried to do that, no, it just, it is a tool that can work sometimes for some people, but it's not a solution to the taffy pull of our modern society that doesn't support artists. And I don't think there is a solution to the taffy pull, but that's part of it. There are way more writers and artists who are out here trying to create while also trying to earn enough to take care of their family and do the physical work of taking care of their family and also take care of their own bodies and do the many things that require our attention. There's way more people out here creating in that taffy pull than there are people who are on a mountainside alone, you know, with someone who brings them their lunch, writing their novel in solitude for 2 years or something. And God bless those people. I've read some of their books and I love them. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not accessible to most people and it doesn't stop them from creating. So I feel like when I think about productivity, I do ask myself, what are the lies or the traps that I'm falling into that make me think that the product is more important than the process? That what I generate is more important than how I generate it or why I generate it or who I am generating it for. What, meaning the quantity, that the quantity matters more than all of those other things. And in some ways, it gives me a lot of freedom. I mean, there are realities to the publishing world that if you are not going full steam ahead to market yourself and market your book and get your next book contract, that has consequences. Like, those consequences are real. But at the same time, I don't think it makes me feel differently about myself as a writer, if that makes sense. Like, I know if I'm not hitting the pavement trying to sell my book, and I am, but I'm hitting the pavement trying to sell my book the way a mom of four who works full time and is chronically ill would do it, you know? And that the way that I do it, I know that it's will impact future book contracts and stuff like that. I'm not like lying to myself. It's more that I don't feel like that means I'm not as good of a writer. Does that make sense? I no longer feel like, oh, but if I don't do X, Y, and Z, I'm not going to get the next book contract that I want, which means I will have failed. And those are the things that I uncouple. It no longer feels like a failure to me. I feel like I love writing. I need to write to understand being human, to exist as a human. And I do also love sharing. So I hope that somebody continues to publish my work because I like to share, you know, I like to find other poets that way. I like to be in communication with other writers. But if nobody ever read any of my poems, I wouldn't feel like that had a bearing on my worth as a writer or the quality of my writing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So one thing I noticed that you were looping in and around there is you kept saying, I no longer feel. Implying that you did at one time feel.
Oh, totally. I was like a super perfectionist, like very much believing that my work was tied to my worth person. And I was young. I think I went through this process younger than a lot of people do because the circumstances of my life sort of required it of me. I think a lot of people might ask themselves some of these questions perhaps a little later, like in their 40s or 50s or 60s or beyond. For me, that questioning, that, do I really believe this? Do I really believe I'm a better writer if I put out a book every other year? And don't get me wrong, I have those thoughts still sometimes. Like, this book, Larkspur Queen, it was under contract and it was supposed to come out exactly 2 years after my first book, Book of Lullabies, mm-hmm. came out. And I loved that. I was like, yes, a book every other year. I'm right on track, right? The thought slipped in there. And the contract failed, which is a whole long story, but it was upsetting at the time. But one of the things I was upset about is, oh no, now my pretty timeline is gone. But I think the difference is I was able to sort of quickly be like, fuck the timeline. Like, there's mm-hmm. no timeline. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book and I'm really proud of the book. Like, at that time, I didn't know if anyone else would pick it up. And I even was okay with that. I was like, yeah, I needed to fucking write this book and I fucking wrote this book. And I felt really okay with that. Mm. I am very glad that somebody did decide to pick it up and that it is in the world. Again, it's nice to be able to connect with people in that way. I love mm-hmm. reading other people's poetry and I like to throw in my small offering to the wider collective. But I think when I was younger, I just would have felt like a failure. And that would have been the end of the thought. There wouldn't have been the fuck the timeline thought that came after. And this is one of the reasons why I love talking to writers, and especially other mothers or disabled writers or writers who are just operating outside of the ideal sphere of what we might picture as what a writer is quote unquote supposed to do in their career trajectory, is because so many people talk about similar things. They had a great agent and their agent dropped them, or they had, you know, a book all written out and they couldn't find anyone to buy it, so they wrote a second book. Mm-hmm. People have a lot of these stories. This is what the creative process is. But for some reason, I think we often walk around thinking that that's not right or that we've done something wrong, mm-hmm. when really that's how it is for most of us. It's mm-hmm. actually not dissimilar. This is perhaps a weird comparison, but I'm going to make it anyway. I think people often see other families that they don't know well walking around with their mm-hmm. one or two or three happy, healthy kids. And they're like, oh God, everybody just gets to motherhood so easily. And they don't know how many miscarriages that person had, mm-hmm, or how mm-hmm. many years they did infertility treatments for, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or how they always wanted 5 kids, but they had to have a hysterectomy after their second. Nobody mm-hmm, sees mm-hmm. the messiness. They just see the happy family, kind of. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I feel like this comes up sometimes with writing and other forms of art, where we do see the end products. We see people posting about their books on social media, and we don't necessarily see all of the messiness and the pain and the weirdness sometimes that came before. And it can be easy to forget that it's there for everyone. Everybody has a messy, weird, sometimes painful creation story to their artwork. Nobody gets a book out there and doesn't suffer in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I feel you. I think that in the creative process and also in life, as you're alluding to both, there's often this feeling of it's them, not me, right? Those judgments and those reactions are actually more about yourself than about that person, whether it's their great, successful book contract or their beautiful family, right? And so I think definitely for me personally, that's been something I've been having to unravel and unpack with age as well. And it's so alleviating, actually. You would think that would make it worse. It's actually really alleviating because then you're not carrying that around in the world in terms of those judgments or those but also just recognizing those reactions are very human and that's very normal. And okay, can give myself a break now.
Absolutely.
It's a big work in progress.
Yeah. Sure. And I think it's something we do over and over again. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I mean, it's not that I don't have these self-defeating, self-judgmental thoughts where I sort of take the mantle of the patriarchy and capitalism and ableism and I put it right in my own mouth. I do this too, but it's so wonderful when we can start to understand other people and understand ourselves well enough that we can notice it when we're doing it and decide to put it down, like you said, to not carry it anymore. To just be like, oh, I can actually just put this down. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't need to keep carrying this around.
Yeah, no, but you're right. And I think that invisibility, it's so interesting that we make the work invisible. Like what you're saying, you don't see the process that got you there as a creative person, or even as a parent, or as a human in general. And so the invisibility of that process and the turning away from it, or the lack of recognition of what that looked like. And also obviously what privileges or supports or whatever were part of that process too. And maybe this is some of this, as I alluded to, the social work program that I'm in, but I just feel like I've become better at just calling those things out, not on other people, but in myself at least, and being like, I don't need to be ashamed about the fact that I have a partner who works in an industry that gets paid more because that's the way that capitalism works. And he and I can work together to unpack what that means. And we can also work together to leverage that to do things, to provide things, to teach our children things, to teach our community things, to help our community, right? What does that mean? And what do I do with that, right? Rather than it being this shameful thing. There are certain things that people feel shameful about, whether it's the amount of help that they have from a family member or whatever that looks like, not being able to admit, well, this is where I got where I am, because somehow it diminishes the worth. Like you were saying, I love what you talked about with the worth tied to the work, right? When we unravel those and we detach them, then I think we can live more whole lives.
Yeah. And I think for whatever reason in American culture, we do have this thing where everybody wants to prove that they're working the hardest. You know what I'm saying? Then you're like a better human, which is not really true, and takes away from people who might need to talk about the ways that they are working too hard and need more support because everybody's so busy being like, well, no, I'm actually working the hardest. You know what I mean? It makes the conversation that needs to happen unable to happen. And I think when we release the idea that how much we work is somehow an indicator of how worthy we are as a human, it frees up a lot of other thinking. Even what you were saying about trying to come to terms with and assess and unpack your own privilege, which I also am in constant process of. I mean, it's a constant process. You know, I can't pretend to have made progress. Sometimes I think I'm making progress and then I'm just like, oh, wow, look, there's this whole thing that I have not attended. It's very much a constant practice. But one of the things that I have noticed is if I am able to assess and address and unpack privilege or have the practice of looking at it in my own life, it allows me to notice where I might have been making judgments of others that I don't actually believe in. So an example for writing might be if I see someone splashed all over my social media all the time and getting big publications, big journals, a really big publisher, all this stuff. And I'm sure it's because their writing's fantastic. And it might also be that their writing's fantastic and they work really hard and they have a lot of time to pursue those things because it takes a tremendous amount of time to market yourself in that way. And then I might see another writer who is not splashed all over social media, but they put a poem on Facebook. You know, it's not even published by someone. They're just putting it up themselves. And I read it and I love it. And I think, damn, I love this poem. And maybe if I wasn't aware of things related to privilege, I could see that I might not realize that both poets might be equally worth my attention. Do you know what I'm saying? It's much easier to read the poem that's not even officially published and think, wow, I love that, and then click through and buy their book or, you know, find them on social media and be like, I want to go to their reading. Like to trust, I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is I feel like having a little bit of awareness around privilege helps me trust my own perceptions of people and their work a little better because it helps me put down some of those judgments that are really coming from our wider culture that sort of champion certain types of productivity and champion whiteness, unfortunately, and champion wealth and champion health and all of these things I don't really agree with. But if I'm not questioning them daily in my own life, it's going to be much harder for me to see through them in my sort of outward facing life.
Yeah, I hear that. You're a person clearly who's doing a lot of work. As I said, you're holding a lot and you're doing a lot. And it's productive, even though it's not. I mean, we can reframe what obviously this whole podcast is about, reframing that word and what it means in our relationship to it.
This is reminding me, can I interrupt you? Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
God. You're talking about white heron. This is a
copy. Oh gosh, yes.
But in relation to this book, I actually have a hilarious, I don't know if it's hilarious, I find it hilarious, story related to productivity and White Heron and Larkspur Queen, this poetry book.
Okay, so just to clarify, since White Heron is so random to most people probably, it is a beautiful tea and coffee shop in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Is there anything more
you can say about it? New Hampshire, you have to come. It's independently owned. The owner is just, this is his heart work, is to share tea with the world. And the baristas, I mean, I'm sure they have other heartwork too, but I swear when you walk in there, you feel like their heartwork is to just share community and like coffee and tea with you. But my sort of maybe only hilarious to me productivity story is that when my third child was one, so this is before the pandemic, this is before I even imagine I'm going to have a fourth child. I thought I was completely done after my third. And I did not have a book out. So I was struggling with, I'm very dedicated to my work as a writer, but what does that mean if I don't have this tangible object to show the world? You know, again, all those feelings that I think a lot of people live with. And I was struggling to find time to write. I was working like three jobs at the time, and I just felt like my brain was in so many different directions. My kids were not in childcare. Only one of them was in school. And so Sunday afternoons when the one-year-old was napping was the time that my husband felt like he could let me leave, not because he didn't watch the kids normally, but because he was often watching them by himself on the weekends while I worked. Mm. So we were both tag teaming. So the idea of me being like, honey, can I have an afternoon to go write poetry, when I just left him for 72 hours with three kids by himself, three kids under five, so that I could work for pay that the family needed. It's not that he wasn't willing. It was more just like, how much bandwidth could either one of us have? Frankly, if he had wanted an afternoon to go hang out with friends, I would have told him absolutely not. So Sunday nap time, we were like, okay, I think it's fine for me to take that. And so I would go to White Heron and I would get a cup of tea. They have this amazing tea. It's called Spicy Licorice Mint. So if you're ever in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, you have to get it. And I would get my spicy licorice mint tea and I would sit by the window and I would be like, this is my writing time. I'm so ready. And I did this for like maybe close to a year. And Caitlin, I wrote nothing. Nothing usable, I should say. I would type the same bad few sentences over and over again. I would try to write poems and they were awful. They were just crap. And I was like, oh my God, is poetry dead inside me? Like, what is happening? I finally have this little bit of time that I can count on. And nothing productive was coming out of it. And I was terrified. I thought I had lost it. I was like, "That this is it. I don't know." But I just kept showing up, maybe because it was like my pre-scheduled hour. I did really like the tea. Maybe I was just showing up for the tea. But I just kept showing up. And then the thing is, I knew what I wanted to do for the book. I understood sort of what my... I understood my self-imposed assignment, I guess you could say. I had a very specific idea for what I wanted to do, and I couldn't make it happen on the page. And then something happened after I was doing this for months. One night in the middle of the night, I was like, oh my God. And I just stayed awake and wrote. I wrote like half the book in 2 weeks. Just by which I don't recommend to your listeners, but it was because it was suddenly there. It wasn't like I wasn't sleeping because, I don't know, I wasn't making time for myself. I wasn't sleeping because all of a sudden the poetry was there and in the day I was busy. So it just all came out in a rush. And after the fact, I had to sit there writing crap for months, drinking this tea and not being quote unquote productive in order for whatever needed to fall into place in my brain to fall into place so that I could create these poems the way they were meant to be created. Like, I knew in the moment that it wasn't working, but I didn't know why. And I needed to sit in that unproductive space to get to a point where I could make it all work again. So that's my I guess it's not, I feel like it's funny, but I guess it's not actually funny. It's just a process story. But yeah, so I'm a big fan. I actually even talk about it in my acknowledgments. I mention Heron because I felt like I had to sit there with the tea not being productive. That was part of the process. That ended up being the process.
I love that. The writer in me, of course, I've got two metaphors. The tea steeping, can't just pour water on leaves and think it's going to be delicious. And it takes time to sit with it. And I love that you were also able to give yourself that time. And despite some of the self recriminations and doubt that you clearly had, there was a little bit of a portal left to open up. I was also thinking immediately of having given birth three times, of the long prodromal labor that happens for some people. And then this really precipitous birth at the end of it. You think, why is this taking so long? And I'm never going to give birth. And now I'm 3 weeks after my due date or whatever an estimated due range. And, you know, then all of a sudden you give birth quickly.
It's so true. And much like birth, you can't really force it or pick it. We can try to put parameters on birth. Mm-hmm. You know, we can say, I would prefer these things to happen. This is within my comfort level. This isn't. But at the end of the day, you are not really in control, right? And you're right. I think that there is an overlap with creativity, especially when we're looking at the whole long arc from first idea for a book through the entire writing process and the revisions and everything, and then the whole process of finding someone to publish it. You don't really have a lot of control over so many of those elements. Yet, I also work as a writing mentor, and part of writing mentorship, as opposed to writing coaching or editing, is a deep and abiding belief in the creative process and prioritizing the process and one's relationship to creativity over the product. So it's not that you don't also have goals that might be related to completing a story or getting it published, but it's that that isn't the end all be all, that the process matters. We don't have as much control over the process as I think we like to. Like I said, with the writing a book in 15 minutes a day, I mean, I would love to tell people, yes, I showed up to my Sunday afternoon nap time writing session. I just worked really hard and then the book's done. That is what I would like to be able to tell people. But it wasn't what was waiting for me. And so I had to just embrace what was waiting for me. And now, because that arc is complete, it seems like a happy story. But let me tell you, when I was in it and I was showing up and staring at my cup of tea and writing really bad poems, I wish I had saved them because they were so bad. I'd love to share them just so people could be like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, that's trash. you know, just make other people feel better. When I was in that, I really did not feel, I mean, I kept showing up, but I didn't necessarily feel comforted by the concept of believing in the process. Do you know what I'm saying? It's much easier to believe in that after the fact. But there's a truth to it that we can't escape, even when it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, like you said, that there's now this book at the end of it, that we always crave that some kind of outcome. I don't know if it's like the hero's journey just repeated again and again to us from childhood and different cultural references and passed down through traditions and oral histories and all of that. But it's this sense that there has to be some pot at the end of the rainbow. There's like some
completion. Yeah.
The completion of the thing. And it's like, what if there isn't? I mean, I know a writer who sadly passed away while they were in the middle of writing a book. And it's like, what is that book? Yeah. Like, what is the end? Like, what is the end? I mean, I think we struggle with that even as creatives as well. Like, when is the product done and ready to be let go of?
Perhaps to some degree, we all die before our creative processes are finished.
right.
But, you know, the person that you're speaking of who passed before their book could be finished or published, no one would say that person was not a writer.
Right.
Sometimes we can see that more clearly in other circumstances, but we struggle with it with ourselves. I feel like I meet a lot of writers who are like, yeah, I'm a writer, but they're hesitant to claim that space until they have that thing to show for it, whether it's a book or whether it's like a teaching position. But I want people to have that sense of completion because it's joyful, but it doesn't define the weight of a creative life in your own lived experience. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like this person you're speaking of lived a fully creative life, regardless.
Yeah, no. And as you were talking, I was thinking that I think that's probably what draws both of us to these kinds of conversations, is that they allow you to value the process, right? That's the whole point. And I think when I was thinking about this podcast and these conversations, despite the fact that the first season, especially, like, I was talking to people who had works out in the world. And obviously, like I said, I want to talk to you about your book as too, but these aren't just conversations, right? You've, I'm sure, listened to those podcasts and they're great and they're important in the world too, but they're a different side of things when you're just having a conversation about that particular book or work. And it is putting so much value on that finished product, right? Rather than let's talk about what came before, or can I talk to you while you're in the middle of it and maybe never at the quote end of it? Or can we have a conversation that removes the need for that piece of it, as you're only working towards that end, right? As opposed to your white heron days of looking out the window at a winter scene. Hey, Winslow. You're reminding me as he's doing that, that I never went to it. Always, you know, those things that you see when you're deep in the trenches of early motherhood and you're like, oh, that's the thing I want to do. And then, of course, you're deep in the trenches of early motherhood, so you never do it.
Yeah.
Which was, there was this group that would meet occasionally at this coffee shop. And the thing was, of course, because it wasn't like right around the corner for me, like, I was going to have to probably drive there. But they had these parenting creative work sessions where you'd bring the kids and there was a little space. And I don't know if they'd hired someone or if people just would take turns, or, and there was play space for the kids to play and you could sit and have coffee and do your work. And but the other thing was, it wasn't frequent. It was maybe once a week for 2 or 3 hours, or for whatever reason, I just couldn't make it work. And now my kids are big and they would just sit and play with little toys. But I remember thinking, oh, it's so lovely. And as it was, you were attending to your child, I was like, oh yeah, that, those moments of, if you could just put all the kids together. And
yeah, I feel like probably a lot of people do this, but when my third born was, again, in that kind of 1 year old phase, he's a very busy kid, I got a ball pit for my house.
Nice.
And a lot of my work got done by putting the kid in the ball pit. But I love that people were doing that. I haven't seen anything like that around here, but that doesn't mean they're not.
Nicole Haritunian, who is a, what do you call, a blurber, what would be a nicer word? Blurber doesn't sound right.
There is a nice word for it. Testimonial. She gave a testimonial.
Yes, for the book. When she was out in San Francisco, she did an event that actually was on the podcast you might have listened to.
I did.
In a bookstore, which is wonderful, Blackbird Bookstore. Catherine Grantham's the owner and is wonderful. And at the bookstore, they have this back area and they do mom group type meetups, caregiver groups. So Nicole did a reading in the morning, which, as we know, never happens. And for parents, it's impossible to get to readings at 7 o'clock on a weekday. And so they did this as a way to connect with that community. So it was at the same time that this group normally gathers. Mm-hmm. And it was also an opportunity for that group to then sit and have this cultural moment, right, of listening to someone read from their work, which is something they don't get to do. So I was like, oh, this is genius. This needs to happen more. I don't know if they're still doing it, but I loved that as an offering.
I love that because, like you said, it's impossible to go to readings at 7 o'clock at night when you haven't, well, depending, it's harder. I did go to a lot of readings with a sleeping baby, you know, strapped to my chest.
Same. But yeah, same.
Then sometimes you're at a different phase and that sleeping baby will only sleep in their crib in total darkness. Mm-hmm, you can't. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also, this is also reminding me of, you know, we're saying your kids are a little older. And sometimes I find, not, they're not that old, but they're not the baby stage. And sometimes I find myself thinking, now that we are out of the baby phase, how can I help support other poets who might be out there working with infants, and I might not see them easily because they have infants and they're busy. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? One thing I think about from my own time with infants is nobody ever invited me to readings. I shouldn't say nobody. I had some very, very dear, thoughtful friends who did. But my first book came out right after my youngest was born. So I had a newborn and I had 3 other very young children. People did not invite me to stuff because they assumed I couldn't go. And I understand that, but it would have felt so different if they had been like, Meg, we really want to read with you. What would work?
Mm-hmm.
Would a daytime Zoom that we share later, or would a a weekend reading in the afternoon? Like, what would work for you instead of just being like, well, poetry readings happen at 7 o'clock at night on a Thursday, and then we all go out to the bar afterwards and stay till the morning. And Meg can't do that, so we're not inviting Meg. And I think, again, related to what we were talking about different layers of privilege, we see this in motherhood. How can we include mothers? If we're not seeing a mother show up to events, is that because she's not interested, or is it because it's not acceptable to her? And then that can be extended to other groups. If I'm not seeing certain people at events I'm hosting, or if I'm not seeing whole groups of people at community things that I'm going to, why is that? Who is reaching out and saying, hey, we want you here. How can we make this work for you? And if nobody's doing that, am I the person who needs to do that? In some cases, yes. And in some cases, no. But I do think about that. And that's one of the reasons why I love Nicole's story times, is because she thought about, well, what do people with very young children actually need in order to go to a reading? It probably has to be at a different time. Yeah.
Right. Right. 100%. Yeah, no, that's very true. You're reminding me, it's sort of unrelated, but of a lot of community work I've been doing, and in really thinking about access, what is the best way to support the most access for that community? And it might not look like what you think because of the parameters of your own life. I was at an event last night with the superintendent. It was this fairly small event, which was lovely, and I was grateful to have been invited. But this subject matter of parental involvement in terms of learning came up, and someone present had said the school's district is just one facet of a child's academic development, but a parent also needs to be involved. And it was a big enough group that I was like, I'm not going to say anything, but I thought most parents want to be, I would assume the vast majority of parents want to be involved. They can't, because we don't have a basic income in this country. You know, people are working second and third shifts. And so, I mean, that's what I see in our community at our Title I school. It's not that people don't want to be there. It's that they can't. And so that shift of perspective of putting the onus on the individual versus putting the onus on the community and the structures and the policies.
And also understanding that involvement might look really different things through different lenses. So my oldest is in middle school, and they have different ways to meet the teachers. There's back to school night, and there's a conference that shows up. And all of these things are difficult for everybody, right? Because everybody's so busy. But then there are also all of these sort of online check-ins, ways to check in online. Mm-hmm. There's different portals.
Right.
And parents are supposed to go on and check their kids' work in the portal and make sure they're turning things in. But doing all of this without being too helicoptery, I suppose. And I had a very, very old computer, and it didn't really work with the online portal. So it's not that I wasn't checking it, but it was difficult to check it, and it would sometimes crash, and I couldn't see all of the things on it. So mostly I was just asking my child if they were checking it at school, because the students also check it. And there was sort of a kerfuffle in the spring where my child was telling me they were doing all of their work and actually someone was missing. And I had this moment of, I am failing as a parent because I'm supposed to be involved in this way where I'm checking up on the work. But the problem was not my lack of caring. The problem wasn't even really my busyness. I was very busy, but I would have made time for it. It was that the computer didn't really work with the system. And my child, because we're a fairly low-tech family, didn't really understand the platform themselves. Mm-hmm. They were not super tech savvy. I just got a new computer. Yay. And the platform works perfectly fine on my new computer. And I have been checking this stupid student portal maybe too much. And I had a teacher comment on how wonderful it is that I'm so involved. And I was like, oh, I don't know. It was just this weird moment where I realized I wasn't uninvolved when I wasn't checking. There were these other things going on that were not solvable at the time. I couldn't get a different computer at the time. I think that's important too. Not everybody actually has the same 24 hours in the day, because some people are working such long hours or have other constraints on their time. But it's also sometimes there are assumptions about access that aren't accurate. I'm assuming somebody thought the student portal was great because it was, you can access it from home, you can access it from school. it's not going to be true for absolutely everybody.
Yeah. And that's assuming that people have Wi-Fi access.
Wi-Fi computers, like, that they understand how to use it, especially if it's grandparents raising kids. They might be old enough that they really don't know how to use it.
Right. Or don't speak English as a native language. So anyways, there's all sorts of access.
You could go on and on.
100%. But, yeah. But
just that comment where if somebody says, well, it's really people, parents need to be involved. And I think what you're really speaking to is how important it is for everyone in the room to be able to be like, okay, that is true. But do we really believe the problem is that parents just aren't involved? Or are there other problems? Are there barriers to involvement that we need to figure out what they are and figure out how to resolve them collectively as a community?
I think that's a wonderful full circle, because we started talking about feeling isolated and finding ways in which to build bridges and community, and that this podcast, like you said, I mean, for me, because I couldn't get out, because I couldn't go to readings, because I wasn't getting invited to things, it was my lifeline to feeling connected still. And it was the technology that I could use. It was the portal that I could use to do that. And I think reading, going back to your book, reading your work now, I feel that same connectivity. And I was wondering if you could close us out with a reading.
No, I would love to.
May I direct you to one of my, I mean, I love them all, but for the purposes of this podcast and this conversation as well, can you read Anyone Who Thinks Thunderstorms Are Romantic Has Never Lived in an Attic Apartment on Top of a Hill in an Otherwise Flat City? Did I say that appropriately?
Yes, you did. I am going to read this one. And
yay.
You know, I'll also share, this is something I wrote before I had kids. This is...
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, this is a throwback to Meg when she was much younger. And I really did live in an attic apartment on the third floor on top of a hill in an otherwise very flat city. Portsmouth is sea level, for those of you who are not familiar.
So question though, did you edit this at all after you had kids?
A lot, I'm sure.
Okay, so it germinated before kids, but it... culminated. Is that the, are those the right words?
Yeah. 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 And actually, I think I've told you before, my first book and this book were at one time one giant, massive book. And I kind of realized in the process that they were really two stories. I was telling two stories and I needed to separate them out. But this one is about, well, I'll read it, but it's really anchored in the self. And that was, I think, a lot of the story in the second book, in Larkspur Queen, is about that kind of relationship to self. And that does shift so dramatically, I think, after we become parents. So I'm sure it was heavily revised after I became a parent, in my own relationship to self changing. Okay. Anyone who thinks thunderstorms are romantic has never lived in an attic apartment on top of a hill in an otherwise flat city. The woman is angry. Yes, she is frequently angry. The woman is also tired. The woman will forget who she was when she was 10, and there will be certain advantages. The woman will come out shaking. The woman will start to think like her mother, and this will help her get along better than ever, with the sense of belonging she always wanted, and the sense of fatigue. And the woman will come out shaking. The woman has been given a lot. She was born to be grateful. One certain advantage will be this gratitude. She practices. She finds she can learn to be grateful one night a week in an art class where she drinks cheap wine and paints copies of pictures someone else made poorly, drinks more cheap wine. This is called me time, and me is at a cancerous level. Though the woman has had cancer already, and it changed her life, of course, already. Ah. But what we all want is a changed life. We want to be shaking. We want to be certain. Everything the woman ever thought is wrong. The skin can't tell the difference between very hot and very cold. It only knows it's ruined. And we are all skin creatures, loving tight jeans, silk pajamas, iced cream, hot coffee. Don't tell me you don't understand. You do understand. And you do cry at night when the thunderstorm rolls over other towns far away and doesn't flash here close enough or at all.
Thank you. I love the little chorus you have behind you as well that's happening.
That's my four-year-old for anyone who's wondering. I am letting him dismantle a collection of holiday things he found in my closet.
Oh, like
Easter
fun.
Egg dye, party beads, buttons, like for Thanksgiving. Just a whole like, holiday fun all on the bed behind me.
Nice. That will be a fun adventure. Could you read the last poem in the collection?
Sure.
Thank you.
I want to say about the Thunderstorms poem, that part at the end where I say, don't tell me you don't understand. That's totally me calling out all the weirdo poets out there, both who actually write poetry and who write other things or create other things. Mm-hmm. You know, the other people who like to have the deep conversations like yourself. This one is called Thank You, Joy, for the Horses. This is the last poem in the collection. Thank you, Joy, for the horses that ran me, pulled me like the wetted wool fibers in a homemade valentine, like the left horn of a too young bull surprised through the side of a white pony, testing out the marshes for the thaw. Thank you for the sharpness of hoofs in the heat of runned animals in February, for their steam in a cold barn. And there is nothing in my life violent enough. There is nothing in my life so violent enough, except this, if I count this.
Yay. Or thanks. Or just take some Mardi Gras beads and sling them around, whatever the beads are happening.
It's a party over here, Shay Meg.
Oh my gosh, Meg. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything I haven't asked? Anything that you feel like you need to say on this amazing opportunity for the two of us to actually sit down and put everything else in our lives aside and have a conversation?
I think I just want to say again, thank you so much for creating and holding space for these conversations here online, but also in your creative life. I see the way you show up for other writers and other creatives and just sort of show up with open arms and a lot of room for the weird singing.
Oh my gosh, the beads are all over there. Look, look, look.
You see? Yeah, that's we're going amazing. Straight after this. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I'm your host, Caitlin Salamini, and this is the Postpartum Production Podcast. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating. This will help us reach more listeners like you who are navigating the joys and pitfalls of artistic and parenting identities. For regular updates, visit our website, postpartumproduction.com. Follow us on Instagram at Postpartum Production Podcast, and subscribe to our podcast newsletter on Substack. Thank you for listening, and we are so grateful to have you with us on this journey. Postpartum may feel like forever, and sometimes it may feel very lonely, but you're not alone here.